Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Shadle against the Iowa Interstate Railroad. Mr. LaRue, are you there?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please proceed. Mr. LaRue, let's suppose we agree that this should be governed by federal common law. Why would federal common law include a rule of claim reduction, given decisions like Texas Industries against Radcliffe Materials? Counsel, my question is, suppose you persuade us that federal law governs, why, given cases like Texas Industries against Radcliffe Materials, would federal law contain the sort of contribution and claim reduction rule for which you are arguing? It is a decision under the antitrust laws holding that as a matter of federal common law, there is no such thing as contribution and claim reduction, and saying that outside the realm of admiralty, the rule of contribution won't be applied. Now, you rely only on an admiralty case, but the Supreme Court has established, at least as I read cases like Texas Industries, that that rule won't be extended outside admiralty. They pretty much treat the Jones Act as part of admiralty, all right. How about cases of employment discrimination law under Title VII and similar statutes? Thank you.
enforcement removal of the decision, rather than it repeatedly goes back to that would be the opposite precedent.
But the Texas case doesn't talk about antitrust per se. What the court is discussing in that section of its opinion is what federal common law itself provides, what's the background rule, if you will. So I'm not sure you can distinguish it as an antitrust case, at least in light of the court's own language. Well, of course, sometimes there's another wrinkle. Even if we were to agree with you that federal common law governs this question, there are many instances in which the Supreme Court turns around and says that federal common law is now going to borrow from the law of the state where the events happen. So via the federal common law vehicle, you get right back to the content of state law. And of course, in this instance, the claims that are being asserted against these other parties are not themselves FELA claims. They exist because there's a state law out there that creates, let's say, liability on the part of the driver to various parties. Why wouldn't we incorporate state law, recognizing, of course, that the states do different things in this area?
Mr. LaRue, if you want to save some time for rebuttal, this might be a good time to do it.
That would be fine with me,
Mr. Garmisa.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may proceed, Stephen Garmisa here for the appellee, Mr. Douglas Shadell. We rely on the unanimous line of cases that say that since, as far as I know, since the FELA was enacted in 1905, the cases have been unanimous in ruling that any right of contribution that a railroad has...
Your opponent has chosen a bad word. He's not seeking contribution. That is, he is not asking that the settling party chip into the pot. Your opponent is seeking claim reduction. Now, why isn't that governed by federal law? Your opponent is saying that the amount you can recover goes down in the FELA action, not in some third-party action.
Because the amount that Douglas Shadell gets under the FELA is set by the text of the FELA, which says that the only allocation, the only re- reduction in damages is for any contributory fault of Mr. Shadell, and as the Supreme Court unanimously ruled last March in Ayers, the only allocation which would reduce the amount of damages owed by a railroad under the FELA is based on the contributory fault of the plaintiff. And here the court says its jury found 50% contributory fault by Mr. Shadell, and the damages were reduced accordingly. And under the FELA, there's...
Well, surely you're not suggesting that if the jury had found 2% fault, that the railroad wouldn't have gotten full credit for the amount it collected, are you?
Collected against who?
The settling party paid in $100,000,
yes.
Limit of insurance.
Correct.
Right. Jury found, if I recall correctly, $270,000 damages reduced by 50%.
$451,000 reduced by 50%. I
suppose the ballpark. Jury had found that the settling party was only 10% liable. Would that imply that your client could collect in total more than the total damages?
No, he only gets the total amount set by the jury. That sets the ceiling.
Maybe I'm just not getting anywhere.
I don't seem to
agree that the railroad gets dollar for dollar credit for amounts paid by the settling party, right?
As long as it doesn't decrease the amount he gets under the FELA.
And where is that credit found in the FELA?
The FELA does not have any...
Exactly.
Yes.
So we're already outside the statutory language. You can't say we look exclusively to the statutory language to determine what the amount of credit the railroad gets on account of a settling party's payment is. That's not provided in the FELA.
I agree if what Your Honor is saying is the FELA doesn't say anything about contribution or credits.
Yeah, as I say, contribution is a misnomer. The claim being made here is called claim reduction. It is not an argument for contribution.
Well, what I'm saying is if the contribution right under the FELA, if the railroad's contribution right is solely a matter of state law under that unanimous line of cases, then so should the... You have to take the state statute in whole, including the claim reduction for settlement, that it's only dollar for dollar and not proportional share. Because he's relying on solely the Admiralty case, and as Justice Stevens noted right at the beginning, there was nothing to better the court's hand in deciding what judge-made rule it thought was the best. So he weighed the court weighed the alternatives, stated expressly that it was a close case, and opted for the proportional share rule. And what I'm saying is there's no reason, there's nothing in the FELA that would permit the railroad to reduce the amount that it would otherwise owe based on a judge-made rule that would overrule and preempt the Illinois statute.
But the thing is, the FELA, all the FELA says, and I guess this is what you're relying on, is the damages shall be diminished by the jury in proportion to the amount of negligence attributable to such employee. But that's actually the question. Should the jury have been asked how much is attributable to the employee vis-a-vis only the railroad, or should the jury have been asked how much is attributable to the employee as a whole, taking into account the driver, the railroad, the employee, because you come out in a quite different place. And I can't find anything in that language that actually answers that second question.
Well, taking the hypothetical, if there was no settlement with Ms. Kowalowicz and the railroad was permitted under the Illinois statute to pursue its contribution claim or a claim over against Mrs. Kowalowicz, then the jury would be allocating between Mr. Shadell's fault, the railroad's fault, and Mrs. Kowalowicz's fault. But as between Mr. Shadell and the railroad, it would only be an allocation as to his fault and the railroad's fault. And Mrs. Kowalowicz's fault would not factor into that at all. He would still be entitled to, under the plain language of the statute, he'd be entitled to recover the same amount of damages reduced only by his contributory fault. So what they're saying is, aha, but since you settled with her for the policy limits, Therefore, we should have a proportional credit. We should have a reduce our amount of liability, and we should only have to pay our proportional share. So if they found that the railroad was only 10% liable, under the FELA, Mr. Shadow could have been 90% at fault. The railroad could have been 10% at fault. Under their plain language of the statute, they'd pay 100% of his liability minus whatever his contributory fault was. It wouldn't matter what Mrs. Kowalowicz's fault was. But they're saying, since you settled with her, we want a judge-made rule that would let us attribute, say 80% fault to Mrs. Kowalowicz, 10% fault to the railroad, and therefore railroad only gets to pay 10% of the damages. Decreased also by his fault.
The fact that the settlement changes the railroad's position in that, if you're following the Illinois law anyway, in that the settlement means that they can't go after Mrs. Kowalowicz for anything. So maybe $100,000 was a good settlement here. Maybe the next time it'll be $10,000. Maybe the next time it'll be something else. But they've lost their right of indemnification.
Right.
The state law right, because the state substitutes something different, which can be prejudicial. It strikes me in this case it's a little bit hypothetical, but it can be prejudicial.
Back in 1905, when the FELA came out, the general rule, I think, was that there was no contribution against joint tortfeasors, so the railroad would have had no right of action against Mrs. Kowalowicz if that was still the law in Illinois.
Well, according to you, it's just whatever the states were doing. If there was some advanced state in 1908, then it would have been that, right?
Correct. Absolutely. Congress left it entirely... What I'm saying is Congress left it entirely up to the states, and there's no warrant to preempt the state statute under these circumstances. And the practical effect of the settlement, a ruling for Mr. LaRue would just be that there would be no settlement with joint tortfeasors, and the railroad would be in the same position. They still owe Mr. Shadell the same amount. They would have their right over against Mrs. Kowalowicz. The only evidence in the record was that she was a homemaker whose husband was an elevator repairman. She had a $100,000 policy. Any sane plaintiff's attorney would take the policy, and that would be it. And there
her rich uncle dies tomorrow and gives her $1 million. I mean, you know, there could be cases where this is significant.
And she could be an underinsured heiress, but there was no evidence presented by the railroad that that's the case. So that's why I think Congress was indifferent to whether or not railroads even had any right of contribution and left it entirely up to the states. So I'd ask the court to affirm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. LaRue? Thank you, Mr. LaRue. Your time has expired.
Thank you so very much.
Now, the case will be taken under advisement. We'll hear argument next in the case of Voices for Choices against Illinois.